This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Alan Scott. This is the place where government actions meet business decisions. Online at www.bgov.com and on air Thursdays at 11 and Fridays at 2:30 right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. You know, it's no secret that the Republicans are not huge fans of Dodd-Frank. In fact, Glenn Hubbard, an economic advisor to the Romney campaign, recently told the Wall Street Journal that Romney would, and I quote, work with Congress towards repealing and replacing the costly and burdensome Dodd-Frank legislation. Got me to scratch my head. I said, self, it's a new month. Where are we with Dodd-Frank now? Katie North is a Bloomberg government finance and policy analyst who actually knows the ins and outs of Dodd-Frank. She'll be here shortly to get us up to speed. We'll also be joined by Suzanne Allard-Levingston, a healthcare analyst with BGov, who's been following the transition to electronic health records, or EHR, as the cool kids call it. Final rules were released recently that may actually have extended the deadline for transition. Is that good? Is that bad? She'll be here in a little while to tell us more. But we're going to kick the program off by examining a few stories released that involved a few of the BGov 200 federal business industry leaders. It's a big book. If you haven't seen it, go check out BGov.com. BGov 200 federal industry leaders company profiles. It ranks all of the big ones who have received money from the government, contractually, that is. So Randy Walerius is a federal business analyst with BGov who's recently done some stories that you might want to pay attention to, especially as we head into a potential sequester. Randy, hello, and thank you for joining the program. How are you?
Hi, Alan.
We're going to start off with the Harris Corporation. And I mentioned sequester just a second ago, merely because these are government contractors. A lot of the money, as they've stated, does come from the government that they do get, and it could be impacted. So they've managed to find some loopholes, or not necessarily loopholes, but here's, you have some news about several companies. Where 2013 may not be as grim as others 2013s may be. So let's start off with Harris Corporation, based in Melbourne, Florida, communications equipment company that received $2 billion in 2011, putting them firmly at number 34 in the BGov 200. Now, the headline of your story says, Harris cuts government dependence in 2012. I understand English, but break it down for me. What truly does this mean?
Well, what's happened in the last couple of years is that the portion of Harris's revenues that come from U.S. government contracts has gone down steadily to 70% in the fiscal year just ended, from a little more than, from almost 80% last year and just over 82% the year before that. So while that percentage has gone down, there's no denying the fact, and Harris says explicitly in its latest SEC filing that it is still very, very dependent on government contracts.
Well, that's interesting because they've got three basic lines of business at Harris. We're talking integrated network solutions, RF communications, which is a lot of government work, and then the one that seems to be their moneymaker, government communications, but they're starting, or maybe not by choice, a lot of it is falling off to the wayside, as you've just mentioned.
They are struggling. Their revenue in the latest fiscal year barely ticked up. And if you look at their three businesses, the RF communications one showed a significant drop from the year before. Integrated networks seems to have done a little bit better. Government communications also up. The government communication ones segment, unsurprisingly, is the one most dependent on government contracts. 97% or so of their business comes from government contracts, with a little bit of stuff coming from the commercial sector. Incidentally, as their government contribution to their revenue has been declining, their international share has been creeping up over the last couple of years by similar amounts to the decline in government contracts.
That RF communications dropped 63% from a year earlier. Unbelievable. Let's move on. Talk about another company here who has a 2013 that could be promising. CACI International, based in Arlington, Virginia, number 26 in the BGov 200, $2.6 billion in 2011 contracts. Big IT cybersecurity company that recently picked up a couple of companies to shore up what 2013 could, to make 2013 that much better. Why did they acquire these?
CACI is betting that sequestration may allow opportunities or leave opportunities, I guess, in the cyber area. They think that the three companies they bought, Pangea Paradigm Solutions, And the third is advanced programs will give them some advantages. Pangea in the intelligence area, Paradigm Solutions, another Maryland company in the cybersecurity and enterprise IT area. And the advanced program manages implementation of Oracle e-business in government agencies.
This kind of makes me laugh because you go back and obviously we're talking about cloud. We're talking about a lot of mobile apps. We're talking about accessibility to government employees or just employees worldwide, whoever you may be, to decide to contract with this company to provide the solution that they could provide. And I look at Apple, the company that basically said, hey, look, we've invented this cloud, but it's been around for a while.
It's been around for a while, but there's still a lot of investment probably to be made, or so at least CACI believes, in some of this technology. Mm-hmm. And their thinking is the technology can make government agencies more efficient. So even as government is cutting costs in a lot of areas, one way to cut those costs is by improving the way they store data, use data, and so on. CACI, which is probably even more dependent on government contracts than Harris is, thinks that by buying some of these companies, it's going to give itself an edge in the coming years. And the three acquisitions we discussed a few minutes ago are only part of that strategy. They've been buying companies for several years. I think they have 11 acquisitions in the last 3 years, most of them in the United States, but also outside of the United States.
Outside of the United States, of course, helping them in the potential sequester, that 10% cut across the board. Let's take a look at one more company here. This one is kind of interesting. I love the title of this. Sharps Compliance sees growth in medical waste. Medical waste. Just the thought of it. I'm sorry. Wrong show. Anyway, so this is near and dear to my heart because I know a lot of people who do have Sharps containers in their own homes. And if we take a look at Senate 725, I think it is, the Medicare Safe Needle Disposal Coverage Act, this is going to benefit not just companies, but people who have those Sharps containers in their homes, like myself. And this is kind of what they're betting on, I believe.
Sharps Compliance is indeed betting on that. They, in their latest filing with the SEC, cited some numbers saying that there are 7.8 billion used needles and syringes discarded annually outside of healthcare institutions. Mm-hmm. They believe that regulation, legislation, other measures are going to increase the demand for their disposal. At the moment, I think they say that about 46% of Americans live in areas where states or other government entities regulate the disposal of syringes and so on. Mm-hmm. 67% of Americans live in areas where disposal of medicines is regulated. So a lot of room there to bring the remaining 50 or 33% into the regulation area.
Helping to control the environmental impact as well. Talking about medicine, and you know, I don't know about you or me, I've got extra stuff. I'm going to flush it down the toilet so my kids don't get it, not really thinking about the environmental repercussions that I'm causing.
Exactly. And the company refers to the growing public awareness to these issues as part of the reason for their projected growth. Unlike the other two companies, they are less dependent on government contracts, although the government did recently end a fairly large contract with them. If I recall, they get about 10% or a little bit less of their revenue from federal government contracts. But yes, the public awareness that you describe is something that they think will drive demand for the management of both the Sharp instruments as well as the medical waste, the medicines.
His name is Randy Walerius. Sharps Compliance, CACI sees opportunity, and Harris cuts government dependence. All articles available now at bgov.com. Randy, will you come back and tell us more as more develops?
Sure. Thank you, Al.
Cool. Hey, so we're going to stick with the medical theme, but shift gears slightly over to Suzanne Allard-Levingston. Hey, Suzanne, how are you?
Hi, Al. I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you very much. So Suzanne is a healthcare analyst with BGov who is going to bring us up to speed with electronic healthcare records, or EHR, as they're called. You were here not too long ago bringing this story to light. Just rewind a little bit. Tell us about electronic health records. What are they? Why are they important?
They're perceived as tools that are going to help improve the quality, the safety, and the efficiency of the healthcare system. Mm-hmm. No small feat. and they're very expensive. And so to help doctors and hospitals and other professionals adopt these things, the government has this incentive program for Medicare and Medicaid providers. You know, as they go along and go through what is called meaningful use, as they prove that they're using these technologies in constructive ways, they get incentives along the way.
So electronic healthcare record adoption has been cruising along, according to the Office of the National Coordinator for Health IT and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. 2010, about 11.5% adoption, 18% in 2011. But some final rules were just released that may slow things down just a little bit. Why are these important?
Well, they're important. They are giving instructions to the doctors and the hospitals of what they have to do to comply with the incentive program. And it's tough to do this. It's tough to train your people. It's tough to have the resources to keep things going. They're coming up with new rules for the technology. So there's a lot going on, and they've gotten the literally thousands of letters for the proposed rule. So in the final rule, they said, everybody take an extra year in this first stage, and then we'll go to the second stage. And everybody's actually rather pleased about that.
Rather pleased with that. We haven't purchased enough iPads to be able to accommodate this yet in our office. So it's broken down in stages, as you mentioned. We're in the middle of stage one. What do we have to look forward to in stage two?
Stage one is basically get rid of the paper, plug in, let's get moving. Stage two is having systems talk to each other. Ultimately, stage three is like, use what you have and show that you're improving quality, and we want proof. You know, it's a big deal to get to stage three. But so stage two, more concrete things are coming out. There's some interesting things in terms of patients' involvement in stage two, which I think is kind of a big deal. Patients have to use a patient portal 5% of the time, and they have to use a patient portal 5% to send a secure message to their provider. And it's an interesting concept, but if you look at it from the hospital and the doctor's perspective, they're being constrained by behavior outside of their own venue.
That's interesting. So they're being held accountable for something that they can't control.
Yes.
At this point. That kind of reminds me, and I don't mean to go off subject here, but it's kind of along the same lines. You remember that episode of Seinfeld with Elaine? Oh, she had the rash, decided to go to the doctor and actually looked in her chart. Had this been implemented at that point, she could have sent a note back to the doctor electronically.
And actually, one of the features of stage two, you know, we think electronic health records, you think they're all the same. Different vendors have different ways of doing things, mm-hmm. and they all don't necessarily talk to each other yet. And part of this stage two is having at least one test where you go one vendor to another mm-hmm. about, you know, a report on your recent visit to the doctor. So for Elaine, in this stage, maybe one doctor would know that she's the one with the rash. But as to all the doctors, that will come later.
Or the difficult patient.
That's
is what
right. That's right.
What do you mean I'm difficult? I wasn't. Back in 1983, you wrote that.
Yes.
Anyway. All right. So we know that the Obama administration is happy about the work that's going on right now. Obviously, we're in an election season. The Ryan Romney ticket. What are their thoughts on this at this point?
Well, it's not clear, but they are bringing it up. I mean, traditionally, health IT has been a bipartisan issue. You know, making the healthcare system more efficient, and it's a tool, and everyone recognizes it's a tool. It's not an end in itself. If you don't apply it, if you don't make the systems in your hospital more efficient, you don't just open the box. You have to take action with mm-hmm. it. But it's perceived as something that's really good and in a bipartisan way. But the Romney folks are talking about wanting to facilitate IT interoperability, which means, you know, communicating. Mm-hmm. It's not clear what that means. Not clear the repercussions of that, but they're talking about it.
There's really nothing clear about their platform at this point. I'm not trying to point that out, but the Obama campaign obviously is saying what they plan on doing. They're obviously doing it at this point and plan on continuing. The Romney campaign has said, yes, we have plans, but they haven't really revealed them. And this is yet another case where we're not quite sure what they're going to do about it.
Not clear to me.
Not clear to me. One other thing, the one important thing, it just struck me a second ago, one of the important things about the electronic health record transfer is the ability to seamlessly, literally, go have a test done and have that information sent electronically off to your doctor. Right now, doctors are responsible for, my wife's a nurse, and she knows after they visit with a patient, the doctor goes back and literally dictates into a phone what's going on. That goes off to a transcriptionist who types the letter, which then gets mailed off to the doctor. Lots of opportunity for failure there. This is going to button up the entire system. So we're really looking forward to the transition. And at least I know I am, and my wife is.
We are too. Although, you know, some of those transcriptions are still going to happen. It's not clear, but it's It's a work in progress.
It'll be going into the electronic record instead of a piece of paper.
Right.
Suzanne, thank you for joining us. Will you keep us up to date?
Absolutely.
Cool. You're listening to Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Here we are more than 2 years later, and we're still implementing Dodd-Frank. The Republicans aren't fans, and if get elected, they plan on some sweeping changes. So will all that work that's been done under Dodd-Frank be for nothing? Will they say, let's clean the slate, or are they just going to make slight changes? I don't know. Maybe BGov finance and policy analyst Katie North has the answer, and she's going to bring us up to speed with the latest on Dodd-Frank. Katie, thanks for joining us.
Hi.
Hello. So H.R. 2827, it's been approved. What does that do for us at this point?
Well, the House passed this piece of legislation. It's one of those kind of legislation that's been in the bucket of Dodd-Frank repeal or scale back. This one in particular deals with the municipal advisor definition and mm-hmm. who has to register. The SEC was forced to write rules on this, but they've sort of put it off a ways. They've implemented a temporary rule and not finalized it. And the banking industry is concerned because they don't want to become municipal advisors whenever they talk to state or local governments regarding some of the initiatives that they work on. And the fact of the matter is that they're already heavily regulated by banking regulators in other ways. And so what this bill actually does is say that if you're already regulated by some other means, then you do not have to register as a municipal advisor.
So Chairman Baucus, he's pretty excited about this. In fact, it passed 21-10-1. He says, and I quote, This important bill would refine Section 975 of the Dodd-Frank Act and capture the truly unregulated who may be offering financial advice to the municipalities. He goes on to reference that this is an extremely worthy goal and one I support, especially since, and he goes on to say, in Jefferson County, Alabama, how unscrupulous municipal advisors pocketed the lucrative fees associated with the county's sewer bond offerings while ignoring the welfare of taxpayers. That's a mouthful right there. But he also says, and this is part I have a question for you about. Even though I agree with the goal of Section 975, I cannot support the SEC's proposed rules to implement it because the SEC's proposal would require thousands more to register with the SEC than Congress ever intended.
Yeah, explain. And I think he's getting at the heart of the issue is that, you know, states and local governments have lost a lot of money mm-hmm. during the recent financial crisis, getting involved in lots of different investments. And so Dodd-Frank is meant to address some of that with people who aren't regulated by any other means talking to the states and local folks. So what this bill would do is keep that implemented, mm-hmm. but kind of walk back a little bit the stake for community banks and other types of entities that are already currently regulated.
Would you say that this period, this month, increment that you're examining here in your Dodd-Frank highlights for August 2012, would you say it was fairly productive, non-productive? I mean, we're looking at about 20 working days, 18 items got addressed.
Yeah, a lot actually happened in August for Congress being out and for a lot of other things going on with conventions and things like that. This was actually a pretty active month. In fact, the SEC, after not having a meeting since April, I think, an mm-hmm. open meeting, held two meetings this month, and they got a package of about three different pieces of regulation passed in final form to implement parts of Dodd-Frank and also the Jobs Act dealing with hedge funds and how they can take a look at potentially doing PR and ad right. campaigns in the future.
So on August 8th, and literally, they've got work here just about every day. Some days they released a couple of different things. But on the 8th, the Federal Reserve, Federal Deposit Insurance Corp, and the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency extended the comment period talking about Basel III. Good, bad?
Basel III is a very huge package of mm-hmm. information. About 700 pages worth of regulations were released earlier this year. And, and you know, the industry and as well as other interest groups, you know, consumer groups have kind of called to take a step back on this and just give a little bit more time to review it and provide comments. So I think that the industry is pleased with the extension of the comment period there. And it certainly was a bit of a surprise to some of the smaller banks that they would get looped into the Basel III scenario because previously, Basel II really only applied to banks with $250 billion or more in assets. So Basel III represents a major sea change in a lot of ways for smaller community banks that aren't used to having these additional capital standards.
That comment period has been extended to October 22nd for those of you playing along at home. Let's talk appraisals because we're always talking about the housing industry and how housing is up, housing is down, housing is this, housing is that. One thing that got us into the financial situation we're in today had to do with housing, the extending of credit to higher risk mortgages that may not have, people couldn't afford them. They end up leaving their houses. So something popped out of this. Explain.
Yeah. So the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau was created by Dodd-Frank to be the central clearinghouse for all sorts of information and regulations regarding not only the mortgage industry, but all other consumer finance issues related to credit cards and the things that we use as financial instruments every day as normal people. And the CFPB, as it's known, has been working on several different packages of rulemaking related to mortgages, including whether or not what a standard mortgage looks like and whether or not you can have point systems or mm-hmm. fees or origination charges, and maybe setting levels and standards for what those might actually be and become in the future. And some of the things that they kind of looked at this month are related to appraisals and making sure that consumers have access to the appraisals that the banks as mortgage originators have in regards to the mortgage that they may be entering into.
In some cases, even recommending multiple appraisals rather
exactly.
than just one, making sure that everything's... Now, one of the things that I found interesting as I was reading that is my family's been in real estate forever, and there's always ways around, what do you mean the house didn't appraise for that? Let's just get another appraisal, you know? Could this be good, bad? Are we looking at something that could end up biting them?
Well, the thought is to really have competition in the right. in the subject and take a look at it. There's always been concerns as to what the actual value of a house is versus what the bank is taking on at that risk. And so I think this is a way to try and just introduce some more transparency into the process.
Makes sense. So like I said, lots of work went on this past month in the month of August. What's on the horizon? What do we have to look forward to?
So throughout the rest of the year, it will continue to be very active in terms of creating all of these new regulations that regulate the systemically important financial institutions, the largest banks that operate in the U.S. And one of the things that we're expecting soon is a package of prudential regulations. These are heightened standards like liability limits and leverage limits and stress testing requirements that these largest, 50 or so systemically important financial institutions have to comply with, and also non-bank financial institutions that may become designated as SIFIs. So we're expecting to see what that looks like. Those rules were proposed late last year, mm-hmm. and we've been waiting to see what the final rules look like. It's a large package of information and a lot of new regulations coming down the pike. We also expect to see a final Volcker rule by the end of the year from regulators. They've been working on this for many, many months, trying to get consensus amongst five different agencies. And we still don't know exactly what the hedging exemption looks like, what the market making exemption will look like. And so we expect to get more details on that by the end of the year.
Where are we with the final rules on credit risk retention at this point?
So we're expecting those sometime probably after the first of the year. They're also tied to other regulations the CFPB is working on, defining what is a qualified mortgage, mm-hmm. which is something that, again, it talks about what will really become the standard for a normal mortgage written in the United States going forward. And once we have those rules in place, then the other regulator, the banking regulators, can work on what credit risk retention means, which requires the banks to withhold 5% of the credit risk of any mortgage, any asset, including mortgages that they securitize.
Katie, we're only one third of the way through this implementation phase of Dodd-Frank. Anything else you want to bring up?
Something interesting that happened this month is an open government data initiative called Legal Entity Identifiers, which the Commodity Futures Trading Commission released a website this month. It's sort of a precursor to what this global legal entity identifier standard would be. And, you see this a lot in different industries, but the finance industry has never had a way to kind of look at exactly who your subsidiaries are that report back up to a bank holding company structure. And it's caused difficulty in the marketplace when you consider over-the-counter derivatives and mm-hmm. having thousands of different counterparties work in these markets. And some of the initiatives with regard to Dodd-Frank are to bring transparency to this. And the CFTC made some progress on that this month in launching a precursor to that called the temporary identifier that they're working on.
Cool. Katie, I'm glad you brought it up. As you can see, I actually have the press release right here. Katie North, thanks for joining me. I appreciate it. I want to thank Randy Walerius, Suzanne Allard-Levingston, and all of you for listening. Make sure you follow us on Twitter at BloombergGov. We'll get together again next Thursday at 11 a.m. Plenty more to say about the business impact of government actions. For Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, I'm Alan Scott.